Okay, let's
tell you
go
more
at
about
it.
Me, but enough about me. So I guess just to stick to the protocol here for at least the first part of the interview, some background information is what the first questions are about. So your age, your racio-ethnic identification, and your gender.
What do you think?
Well, I know. That's, but on tape, it's kind of, they won't see, you know, we don't have the visual, so.
I'd like to publicly laugh at all this formality, I mean, for heaven's sake. So I was born in 43, and I guess I'm Caucasian, who knows, and a male.
Okay, cool.
In this day of uncertainty, I don't feel uncertain about that at all.
Okay. Well, let's get on to the more interesting things. What about, can you just give me a sketch of your formal education, including years of degrees, main degrees?
Elementary school, Manhattan, high school, Massachusetts, Harvard College, Oxford, MA, and then Yale Law School. So that's formal education.
What year was your law degree?
1970.
And then what jobs did you have? So you were a lawyer, or is that what you went into afterwards? No, what did you do after law school?
I worked at McKinsey, so at law school I set up Yale Legislative Services that served legislatures throughout New England and further south, and was much more interested in those sorts of things. So I worked at McKinsey for about 5 years, my first bit with them. Which is a wonderful apprenticeship in a part of it was learning business, because my background was all social. But, you know, how do you, I'd not been to business school, so all the management sciences, how do you go into other people's large complex institutions and very quickly understand them and be able to cause very significant change to happen? That's a set of skills that's very useful if you're an entrepreneur. And all the way through this, environment is an important issue. So my dad was an explorer, that was sort of a hint. While at McKinsey, one of the things I did was the Connecticut Enforcement Project, which was Stan Lufkin became the first commissioner of the Department of Environmental Protection in Connecticut. And I had worked with him as a client earlier, setting up the Opportunity Funding Corporation, Black Capitalism. And so when he became commissioner, he, being a smart person, very quickly figured out that the enforcement thing doesn't work. And so he asked me to come and figure out how to make it work. And out of that comes the delayed compliance penalty, which is in all the federal statutes now, and the roots of emissions trading and a whole series of other innovations. And that was just a wonderful training ground and learning period. So I took a year leave from McKinsey to teach at Stanford Law School with overlap into the business school and then the Kennedy School at Harvard. And Jimmy Carter, by very good timing, contacted me 2 weeks after my old mentor and friend Hubert Humphrey withdrew for ill health reasons. And Jimmy asked me to lead one of his citizen advisory groups I said, these things usually get people in trouble. Are you sure you really want this? And 2 weeks later, one of them really got him in trouble. And for whatever reason, I ended up being part of a small group that he had, quite uniquely, trying to figure out how he would be a good president if elected, using campaign funds for that. So I did all the regulatory agencies and a series of major management areas. I managed to get elected. I worked in the White House, really trying to get the transportation deregulation thing moving despite the opposition of the new Secretary of Transportation. And I had a choice of OSHA or EPA, different levels, EPA at the second level. And Doug Kostol, who had been Dan's deputy, I think I helped him get in, and he was happy to have me. And so we formed a very nice team. We knew one another as the two first political appointees going into EPA. And it was the most intense educational experience because, you know, I had dealt with the federal government from McKinsey, but it's different. And so it was we had the Clean Air Act and all sorts of other legislation going on the moment we walked in the door. And there were just huge challenges at the agency. A great agency with very talented people, but my role there was assistant administrator for planning and management. So you take all these pieces and you put them together into an agency. Planning and management was essentially the role that pulls the whole thing together. So it's the budget, the planning, the policy, all the management functions, the appropriations committees, the White House policy processes. Basically, anything where you needed to pull the whole thing together was in that office. So I think it was one of the 20 best jobs in the country, and maybe well beyond that. And Doug's temperament and mine were very complementary. He would tend to go glassy-eyed after a short period dealing with the budget, and he was very skilled at dealing with external political forces. So it was a very nice complementation. And since I know we're heading towards the transition, it positioned me to understand all the dimensions that the Reagan administration attacked on: budget, management, and everything else. Because, you know, so the regulation development process, for example, was run out of my office, was one of the many things run out of my offices. So every regulation, no matter where from. And so I was just in a really good position to, when the Reagan folks attacked, I wasn't a specialist in this or that. I could see the whole thing. And given my management background, I understood management and budgets really well, like really easily. And the people on the Hill, the environment groups, and the press are clueless about this. None of them basically have ever worked in a large organization. They can't read budgets. And that's exactly why the Reagan people attacked where they did, Stockman being a very smart person. And so they fainted towards the Clean Air Act with no intent whatever of actually doing anything there, because they knew they would have their heads handed to them. But they also knew that it would totally upset the environmental community and get them focused there. So it was classic Clausewitz: faint towards the center, an attack where it's least expected and there are no defenses. And their strategy was to keep the attack at a low enough visibility level that it would never excite a lot of opposition. So they planned 5, 15 to 20% budget cuts over 18 months. So each one of them didn't look so big. But by the time you do 5 times 15 to 20%, had they succeeded, by our calculus, you've only had a couple of hundred people out of the 5,400 at the EPA headquarters staffs that would not have quit by attrition, which was up to 2.7% per month by the time they were in office 6 or 7 months, fired and or bumped as a result of firing. I.e. they would have succeeded in a mass lobotomy of the institution, which was the intent. And so that's very quickly the background.
Okay. I have a bunch of questions, and I think because I want to sort of concentrate on the Reagan transition, I'll just ask a few of these of the earlier things that your earlier experience in terms of when you went into the EPA, you had your first experience there, mainly in or near the White House, and you were overseeing the transportation deregulation and some other things. Then you moved into the EPA. Could you just give me a sense of, you know, how long you were in the White House versus when you made the switch into EPA and had to choose between OSHA and EPA? And also, why did you make the choice you did?
Well,
just in terms of, can you just pinpoint some of that in terms of years? I mean, I'll ask you for your CV, I guess, is maybe an easier way to do it.
It's pretty straightforward. So Jack Watson, who became cabinet secretary under Carter, led this small group, a dozen people. Maybe it was slightly more than that by the end. And our job was to figure out how Jimmy Carter could be a great president.
So that was starting in maybe 1975 or 76, he had already...
So I'm not sure exactly when it got started, because I was not one of the first two or three people, but it was pretty small when I arrived. And it was always small because, you know, they're using campaign funds to do what?
Right.
Most people don't do that, but he did, and it's typical Jimmy Carter.
Planning in advance.
And he genuinely believed that the best politics was doing the right thing. And I can give you lots of stories of that. It was really remarkable. So during this period, the Teamsters came to the campaign and said, you know, Ford had started trucking deregulation. And they said, just don't say anything, we'll support you. And that sounded attractive to some people. And so Jimmy Carter got several options. And of course, he knew more about this than most people. And so he added his own option, which was much stronger than any of the options he was given. So he was not going to allow exceptions for agriculture or department stores. I think those were the two big exceptions.
For deregulation? Is that what, or for what?
Trucking.
Deregulation, right.
Yes, trucks.
I know a little bit of that story.
And so he wrote, after he'd made that choice, they won't like this, will they? ? So, you know, it was just typical of him. And I was involved in that, and my responsibilities were all the regulatory agencies. And things like civil service reform and contracting reform. And so it was a broad mandate because there were very few of us. And so I was in the White House for two reasons. A, I was in the transition, which was less attractive, but continuing the same sorts of things. Just it's a somewhat dysfunctional period.
Right.
And I was trying to help with the, you know, certain people becoming administrator of EPA. And going through, once I had made my own personal decision, so Hubert Humphrey had been supporting me for the OSHA thing, and I just decided EPA was going to be, being sort of a number two at EPA was a much better role, given my learning, than the other. And it was a much better agency and much more interesting, etc. So that was just a personal decision, which I think was a wise one.
So OSHA, you would have been the number one person, or the
well, that's what Hubert Humphrey was interested in. That's not telling what
right.
they would have. The administration would have decided.
Carter, right? He would have had to decide.
Yes. Well, and he has to. He had to decide all these things.
Right.
And so, having Doug become the administrator made the EPA path.
Yeah.
You know, I had support from both sides.
Did you have anything to do? Did you push the candidacy of Doug?
Yes, Huffle? Of course.
Yeah. Okay. So you knew him from Connecticut.
Yes, yes. And I thought correctly that he would be a really good administrator. He's a, you know, another deeply honest person with, you know, a deep sense of judgment. I had seen him as deputy administrator under Doug, and they were very complimentary. So I had no doubt that he would be excellent. And furthermore, coming from a state agency is really important if you're going to run something like EPA. You just, I can't imagine how anyone could function there if they didn't understand the reality of how things actually work at the state and municipal level. So much damage has been done over the years by very smart, well-meaning people at NRDC and other such places pushing things that are just not realistic. They make sense, they just aren't realistic. And so you have to understand that level. And, you know, he and I, and we brought in several other people from Connecticut. So Henry Beal, they put in charge of the regulatory process and the regulatory reform process. And David Tenderman, we put in part in charge of energy. Chris Beck came in and did water. All people from Connecticut with deep understanding. And, you know, Connecticut had been one of those great small agencies where, because of Dan's leadership, and Connecticut's just a very healthy state. You know, except for Westchester, people really know one another. And, you know, you make a deal, people will honor it because they're going to have to live together. You're not anonymous in that state. And we'd put through the Connecticut Enforcement Project, and, you know, I'd had good support in doing that, and we were able to work with the Connecticut Business and Industry Association, I mean, all these groups. And when there was a change of administration, we were supported by the industry folks. They kept their word.
So how did that, I mean, we're interested in asking a couple of things about your time in the EPA. One of them has to do with politics and political influence on the agency and your perception of how that played out, I guess it would be in the Carter years. You suggested a little bit about that, but how would you, you know, framed in that way, how would you address that in terms of your time in the policy and budget office,
Well, it's planning and management. It's a much bigger planning and budget suggests two staff offices. That doesn't begin to explain what planning and management.
Planning and management is far broader. Yes.
To understand it, it's all these different pieces were brought together by Nixon.
Right.
That wasn't that long before we arrived.
Yeah, just less than 10 years.
Well, much less.
6 or 7 years, really.
Well, it came together 71, and we arrived in...
And they were just weaving. I mean, that takes a lot of work to bring together.
So
five
planning and management was the place that's supposed to bring the whole thing together. So to develop a regulation, there is an agency-wide process. Well,
right.
That has to be run by somebody. That's us.
Right. Were you with the administrator's office there? Was it a separate office?
No, this is a huge, huge department. I'd have to check the number, but I think there were 16 divisions, 19 divisions. So there were 4 divisions in planning, and then we had contracts and the audit function.
Right.
We were running the largest public works program at the time, the wastewater treatment plants, and how do you deal with that? And the inspector general.
That was all under the planning management.
That was the concept. The inspector general is independent. So but all the rest of this stuff, anything that cuts across, except for the general counsel's office, was us.
Okay.
And the general counsel, Jody Bernstein, and I were then and are now really close friends, because our job was to make the thing come together and deal with all the vociferous tendencies.
Yeah, I bet. Yeah. And so what about the sort of political influence in shaping that process? Do you see any? I mean, how would you frame that in terms of the influences, external, I guess, political influences like industry, or labor, or environmental groups, in terms of how they had impacts on just generally on what you did, your decision making?
Well, I mean, you can't even think about the role without that.
Yeah.
There's a huge countrywide discussion going on. And so one of my central goals, probably the single most important one when I threw out, was I was committed to getting the bubble or emissions trading in place.
Right.
So this is a fundamental change in the regulatory process. Not limited to the environment.
Mm-hmm.
It used to be command, write the regulation, and control, enforcement.
Right.
Now it's command, counter-proposal, control. And emissions fees don't work. It's just a completely impractical idea, politically and technically. Thousands of academic articles written on it. It's a nutty idea. For most of the environment. Now, I've designed them, the tar and nicotine tax for New York, etc. In some cases, they do work. But, I mean, how do you measure what's coming out of a factory when you have a whole bunch of batch processes, for example? You have such sophisticated devices as this thing, how dark is that cloud coming? I mean,
right.
And so, just technically, not practical, and you're going to impose an administrative burden. We have to deal with every single person as versus a few exceptionals. I mean, come on, this is not realistic.
You mean every single sort of point source within a facility or something?
Well, if you have individual.
Go ahead, continue to explain that.
If you put on an emissions tax, okay, how are you going to do that?
Right.
You have to be able to measure it.
Right.
And everyone who puts that pollutant out, you have to go and collect the tax from.
Right.
Whereas in enforcement, I mean, I'll give you the statistics for Connecticut. There were 14,000 registered sources of air pollution, and we had acute regulatory problems with 6, and pretty serious with 14, and then there's a, we were totally overwhelmed dealing with those. All these academics just, it was nutty. And you'll find some MIT book, I wrote a chapter on this long before any of this got started. It's just not practical. Theoretically good, but just not practical, either politically or technically. And so the bubble solves that problem. You have the same somewhat crazy process, that you have a separate regulatory thing for each source, a paint spray booth. Okay, well, that's different from 100 other processes in a plant. Each one has its regulation, best available control, whatever it is for that, or technology for that thing. Okay, well, the result, of course, is crazy, because you literally have 100-to-1 different cost per pound of that pollutant removed. Process A versus process Q. And I'm not making up. 100-to-1 is quite normal. So, counter proposal, we say, look, you guys, the engineers, you own this. If you figure out how to get more out of the 25-cent pounds, you can drop the $100 pounds. And so you have the same economic incentive to innovate in terms of control methods, changing in process, controls, whatever way. You go at it, dear engineers, all of you. You have the same economic incentive as you do to improve your processes, and then, furthermore, because you own it, you know what to do, and you have the incentive to operate and maintain your equipment. It's a completely different thing. So the alternative doesn't work. This does work, and the most important thing about it is that the sinks don't increase. There is no more air, land, water, or human capacity to absorb anything. But population and economic activity per capita keeps going up, which forces the cost of maintaining any level of pollution control or exposure up. Steeper and steeper, one of those basic laws, unless you have a lot of innovation going on in controls. So my belief was and is that unless you get environmental regulation out of a structure that has major disincentives to innovation and change it so that you have innovation is, that's the only way the environment doesn't lose. If you force the field up that curve, there's going to be more and more resistance, and it's only a matter of time. The only alternative is to increase the rate of innovation, and hence emissions trading. Well, to say that emissions trading was controversial when we got started with it would be a mild understatement. The enforcement people had several flameouts, quite literally, but our strategy was we were going to walk, we could have just said, Trump, like, we're going to have some order. But no, we said we're going to go through the full process, totally open. We're going to learn from the process, and it's going to be legitimate. And it took a while, but we did. And so David Hawkins, who is the air guy, was fabulous. He's very smart. He spent his whole life at NRDC. He was not wildly excited about this. But his approach was to very thoughtfully point out, this wouldn't work, so we kept iteratively improving it.
So there's a dialogue with NRDC. some of the other rooms?
Well, he was at EPA.
Oh, he was at EPA, so that dialogue was internal.
Well, it's also external. Right. You know, we're nothing is a secret.
Right.
And you have to deal with the other agencies and the White House and everyone else.
Right.
And so by making it completely open, no games, we don't do that.
Mm-hmm.
We gained legitimacy, and, you know, by the time it went into place, the opposition hadn't entirely melted away, but there was a pretty good acceptance. And it was a much, much, much better designed thing. So it's survived. It's moved to other fields. You have such places as EDF applying it to water allocation in California. So, you know, and the FAA using it for landing rights at airports. It's, so I think it's, you know, we've had to continue fighting for it after I left EPA. You know, the Reagan people, idiots, they thought that just because it was our idea, it must be bad. I mean, literally, it was that sort of primitive level of thinking. And, you know, we had to run around and deal with that problem, which we were able to do because it was so stupid. But being so stupid doesn't necessarily mean they don't win,
right,
unfortunately. But that was another project over at the side that Save EPA wasn't really dealing with. Its problems,
right, that was
different.
Set of issues.
But so anyway, that's an example of a change was the single most important change on my agenda.
Mm-hmm.
There were a whole series of others. We had some 45 changes in the regulatory process. This is the thing that Henry was leading, which is the regulatory reform group.
Uh-huh.
And we helped Jimmy Carter. How do we deal with all these regulatory agencies that don't talk to one another? So you have health effects research, for example. Well, there were, I forget the exact number, but it was 240 odd, I'm pretty sure that's right. I can look it up if you need. Different federal agencies doing health effects research.
Right.
And some would say, and I forget what the number of regulation, it's a smaller number, but one regulator say, you know, you got to use brown ducks, and the other would say frogs for the same. I mean, it just drove industry crazy. It was totally unnecessary cost. So Carter set up the U.S. Regulatory Council, which we suggested, actually. And so, again,
to coordinate between the policies or harmonize the government
approach
to health effects.
Well, not way beyond that. It's just that's one example,
right,
of where there was craziness because you have all these independent stovepiped bodies that are,
right,
actually working in parallel ways.
Did it have anything to do with the, what was it, the regulatory liaison group? I remember seeing something like that. I've done some work on
it. Well, it may be the same thing. I don't know, but I just think was.
Anyway, let me just, one more thing on this, and then we'll move to the Reagan transition. It sounds like you've already answered a good deal of my second question about Carter years and the EPA, and that is the influence of science and the role of science and engineering and so on. That a lot, it sounds like, of what you're the bubble idea consisted of was giving space for engineers to do their thing, to innovate, and creating some goals for them, but at the same time opening things up to scientific and technical people to really, with incentives and so on, to really incorporate innovation into the way, in private innovation, into the way that regulations work. Am I right about that?
Oh, yes, the purpose is to get managers and engineers, you guys, please figure out how to do this better.
Right.
And, you know, they would then counter proposal. You know, we're not going to do all these leaks and pipes. That's wildly expensive. But we're going to get the degreasing operation to go from 70 to 85%. Well, one place that does that, the best available technology for degreasing goes to 85%. It's very powerful. And you've got to realize the old system was absolutely designed to prevent innovation.
Lock technologies in,
And no one had, look, who has an incentive to do better?
Right.
Well, in theory, the pollution control companies, but who are their clients?
Right.
Yeah, they're going to be really happy with you if you come up with some new technology that's going to cost them a lot of money, and they're sure going to turn to you for their next order. That is not the way things work. There's an article in the National Journal, which I might be able to find, when Reagan came to office and said, look, these guys are all this top-down control. It was, you know, those folks
at
EPA.
Command and control stuff. Yeah, they were accusing
the guys. They came back in with command and control. We were the ones who were putting economic forces to work.
Just one thing about the bubble policy in terms of that. That is the policy that was defended, upheld by the Supreme Court in 1984 in the Chevron versus NRDC case. Is that the one? I think it is.
I don't know the answer.
Okay,
I should.
Well,
I can give you here. Look, give you something that is. This is the delayed compliance penalty. I think we have enough of these.
Oh.
So. This also.
Oh, that's about the Connecticut program? That
yeah, that's one of the innovations in Connecticut, and you'll find it in all the environmental statutes.
That'll be helpful,
So the idea is
I didn't get to ask you a lot about that, but to have something written by you is like, that's helpful.
So we brought a whole series of using economic tools to advance, and we haven't even talked about this, but there are more. And so, we're bringing a very different market-oriented approach and also shifting the internal management of the organization to not be a top-down rules, control, fear. Now, OMB hated that because they
are... Carter's OMB.
Yes. Well, he inherited them.
Right.
And, they are the classic top-down control. Jimmy Carter introduced CBB. We were one of his poster child for that because we really believed in it. And civil service reform, introducing performance pay, there's a coherence to all these pieces. So in CBB, the people all across the agency are involved in decision making and it becomes a management process. And then, OMB thinks they're going to mess with that. They're not messing with my budget. They're messing with the budget that everyone in the agency has worked out.
Right.
And, by God, they're going to get an appeal. And Jimmy Carter likes CBB, and OMB didn't like this a whole lot.
Interesting. Well, I think we need to get on though to these events. First of all, this is based on what I've read from the write-ups of the Save EPA. Your person sent me, and then the other 2004 interview. I understand that you left EPA when Reagan administration came in January of 1981. Now, was that because did you have a choice? you were a political appointee, right? And so you didn't have a choice. I just wanted to make sure that I understood the dynamic there, that you left because Reagan had someone brought in to replace you, who was his political appointee.
Well, I didn't have anyone. You know, it's the usual problem. It's not, Trump isn't the only one who has this trouble.
Right.
You know, the reason I wasn't at EPA right away is, A, I had this transportation thing, but also security clearance.
Right.
So Doug and I were because we started earlier than others, we were the only people from the administration at EPA for months and months.
In the Carter administration?
Yes.
In 77. Or was that 70?
Yeah, 77.
That was 77. And so that took a while to fill out all those AA ships at that sort of middle level. And so where did you go after that? Where were you, what were you doing sort of job-wise over this time when then in August the Save EPA kind of gets broken? Well, where were you? I don't have a, where did you go after EPA?
So I had my plan was a multi-dimension plan.
Okay.
So I went back to McKinsey.
Okay.
And New York office and had a wonderful role there. So in my first incarnation there, I helped create a new practice area in the design of regulatory and tax systems, and hence the Connecticut Enforcement Project.
Oh, okay.
And others.
You wrote it up.
Well, that's one product.
This is actually probably out when you were still in the EPA.
This is, I think, before that.
Yeah.
Yes. So, but I was also starting Ashoka, and I had planned to work on Get America Working. But then, here comes these people, and it became clear after a while, this is really bad. This was not a change in policy, that their strategy was to destroy the agency. And I do not like doing negative things. You know, I create things. That's what I do all my life. But I just felt this was so bad. And I was in a somewhat unique position of being able to understand what they were doing because of my role and background. And
so let me just ask about, one thing I'm curious about is why it took so long for Gorsuch to after she was nominated in February, to then be confirmed in really June it was. So do you have any insights into that process? And that's something I can research. But okay.
I don't know. My guess is security. Yeah. And what I don't know if this is true, I can tell you what I was told, was that she knew she was coming to an agency with a destructive mission, and she was afraid. And she wanted to have enough people around her. I don't know if that's true. I have no insight, no access to her.
Okay. Well, so we get to, according to this earlier interview, it was in August that you were first contacted by a senator, Republican senator. This is what the interview says. Does that make sense? When did you first learn of what was afoot at EPA?
Pretty quickly.
And through what means? How did you get the word? Do you remember?
Well,
I mean,
look, I can give you some examples, and I can't remember what week,
okay.
But this was within a month or two of my leaving on January 20th at noon.
Oh, okay, so it was earlier than this.
No, it was when Senator Stafford got in. That was thank God he did, but we had been working for months. I'll just give you a little sketch.
Okay.
In the administrator's office, they had a chart of the people in the agency, multicolored.
Sorry to interrupt you. Next meeting is ready. So, last question, maybe. Your next meeting is yours.
Okay.
So give me a sense of, okay, like, how did it start? And then who were your allies in making this movement, really, that say the EPA became? Who were your allies? And then do you think at this time it was successful?
Well,
let me just
finish this story.
Oh,
here.
Sure, okay.
Because they had this thing up on the wall, you know, the senior civil servants, and they had them graded as to who they wanted to get rid of. And there were a lot of them that they wanted to get rid of. They had consulted with their friends in industry, and they had a very aggressive hit list. Well, guess what? This is hanging in the agency. Someone sees it. You know, I know all these people. And so, oh, you look at the list, and there is a pretty good correlation between excellence and being high on their hit list. Now, I say that having represented the economics office and the regulatory development office, so, you know, we were the people who were actually saying, you got to take economics into account.
Right, right. You were doing it.
So, it was terrible. And they started treating people terribly. So, Eloise, who worked for me, started in the government as a young woman from very poor South, and she had risen. She was so talented. And they put her in a broom closet, literally. They were terrible. And you treat people that way, guess what? Word gets out. And remember, the contracts and personnel and budget people all reported to me, so I knew them.
That's the career people.
Yes.
Now they have a new,
Well, they can't do a budget without going through budget. They can't fire people without going through personnel. They can't end contracts without going through contracts. And, like, it was really clear. And it became clear within a few months that this was very serious, that they were planning this series of cuts. And I just made the personal decision, which I did not want to do. I had a very full, rich plate I was very happy with, that I was going to have to step up because this required political leadership married to understanding budgets and management, and how many people have that. And so we began organizing, and, here's where you can get the... There's an exact date when Phil Shabakov broke the story on the front page of the New York Times top left-hand column. So 2 weeks before that, I brought the story to the Post, and they wouldn't deal with it because they didn't want to be, you know, the Reagan honeymoon, blah, blah, blah. They didn't want to be, here they go again. I tried multiple avenues, and I just couldn't get them to move. So we then went to Phil, who was the environment reporter at the Times. I knew all these people from my...
Your time in the
80s. Yeah. And had trust because, you know, our approach was we didn't play games. We were always direct and open with people. So... you know, it was very hard that spring because everyone was afraid of Reagan. The only person we could get in any committee or subcommittee to move was Al Gore. And he proposed a tiny increase, not increase, but restoration of cuts in enforcement, and lost. And we knew he would lose, but he at least had the courage to stick his head up above the parapets. But everyone else was afraid. And so our job was twofold: to always have the facts and always be correct, and have them if they were going to hold a press conference, we would be at the press conference with the true facts and the full implications. And over time, people got to understand that we knew what we were talking about and they could rely on us. And so there was what you're seeing now. EPN is modeled on that part of the work. The other part of the work was political, and I can just give you a feel for that. We worked closely with Senator Stanford, and he had the courage as a Republican to lead off and have hearings about this. That was very important for getting people to begin to say, oh, we better look, maybe we shouldn't be so scared of this. And then the second big target was middle January. You know, the Congress comes back, and all those staff people are wandering around, what are we going to hold hearings on, blah, blah, blah. And in 1 week, we had Russ Train, who was being considered for Secretary of the Interior, close friend of the Vice President, sign off on an article, which you can look up, The Destruction of EPA by Russ Train. So that came because I went to Russ with a number of the people he had appointed that he knew really well, and we showed him all the data, and he understood. This was about the destruction of what he and all of us had helped build. And he was courageous. He did something, will take a few moments. We had Art Buchwald, we had Doonesbury.
Right, I saw
we had a whole bunch of people. One, it was just a complete flood. And we got, I've been blocking the name of this woman, you can look it up. She's at ABC, office on DeSalle Street. She caught one of the EPA, Gorsuch was in Colorado, so they didn't catch her. But they got, when this thing started breaking, they invited someone from EPA over, I've forgotten who it was one of the assistants. And they lied. They lied on television, and we'd been in her office for days with boxes of materials and civil servants coming in and talking to her, and she knew the facts. Right. That did not go over well, and basically broke their credibility. And then there were a whole series of hearings a year later, and that ended up badly for them. Very badly. In the meantime, I was having some quiet talks with the Reagan White House political people. This is going to cost you. You really don't want to do this. And because eventually it was going to have to be a decision in the White House. And those people are not part of this fight. They're there for political reasons. And at that point, the national polling showed 14% thought environment was the issue, and it was all one way. And so the Republicans had gotten away with years by, you know, hugging whales. Trump just gave his salary to the national parks. Well, that's what they always do. But they get away with the base politics here is that the environmental movement has a very broad, diffuse base, and it irritates all the organized sectors. This is a terrible problem. It's the fundamental structural problem the field has. And we can only mobilize that diffuse base when we get it up to the point where people begin to see, oh, those people are really hurting our health.
Right.
And the combination of being totally reliable on facts, dealing with the politics, with everybody, without exception, both parties, We also connected with the local environmental communities. Most of the environmental movement is local.
Right.
And we were able to give them a flow of information they didn't have access to. So the political half of what we're doing was totally critical, but the factual-based half was essential, and that was based on, at our peak, about 600 of the best environmental managers in the country. And we organized this in a cell-like structure because they're vulnerable. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I don't think anyone was hurt. You know, if you come out, where do you work? You work for some environmental consultancy firm, and who are your clients? And they're really going to be happy to hear that you're sticking it to Ronald Reagan. And you're making it harder for him to deregulate them. Your clients are going to be real happy with you. So it's very important to protect those people. So the only way you can do that is by keeping people separate. So it took a lot of time and effort, but I think a tremendous damage was done to the agency. But the Reagan White House eventually got to the point, and this is exactly their phrase, quote, "We must anesthetize this issue." And i.e., we then had a truce. They brought Ruckelshaus and Ahm in, and it wasn't great, but the aggressive cutting and destruction came to an end, much short of what they had originally planned. So that's a very quick summary of what this was all about.
That's great.